This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, taped live in Seattle, we discuss the first presidential debate, how much it may have shifted the race, and what President Obama can do to recover. Plus, we welcome special guest Dan Savage.
Americans like to think of themselves as tolerant and inclusive. Even people who may disapprove of the way other people choose to live, who other people are, want everyone to feel like they have some stake in this and they aren't being persecuted.
I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, the new movie thriller Looper has everyone talking about time travel stories again. Are we just going back to the future? Also, the indie band Grizzly Bear and the economics of making it in today's music scene. And finally, the sitcom Cheers turns 30. How does it hold up after all these years?
Well, I am going to need something to kill time before my second beer. How about a first one?
Our show begins with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington, but not that Washington. We are at a sold-out town hall in downtown Seattle. Wow. I'd always heard that the fresh mountain air and plentiful salmon made you beautiful and have luxuriant hair, and I find that it's true. So joining me on stage, to my left, is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
And to my further left is Slate chief political correspondent John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello. Hello, David. Let it be recorded for the record that I didn't get the cat call.
Drummed that okay, one up.
Yes, exactly. Well, this is a state known for fishing, so I thought I would do a little of it.
So what a perfect day for GabFest. We are a day after the first presidential debate. Why did Barack Obama look so sad? We're going to dissect what Mitt Romney did right and look ahead to the rest of the campaign. And then with the race still tight, we're going to look after the campaign to what will happen to the Republicans if Romney loses and what will happen to the Democrats if Obama loses. And we're going to have a very special guest who will sit in that empty chair. So, John, you were at the debate last night. Mitt Romney gave a beatdown to President Obama. Was that the general sense in the room?
Well, you know, it's the funny thing about being in the room is that we've already generated more noise in here than that room generated for the entire night. It's this very weird experience. So the president and Mitt Romney are on this blue stage, heavily blue, with the words of the Constitution and Declaration of Independence behind them. And then Jim Lehrer sits at the edge of the stage as if it's at the edge of a galaxy. The rest of the room is black, and there are people out there, and they know it. But you can't hear, I mean, you can't even hear the rustle of someone crossing their legs. It is, because Lehrer comes out and tells them for like 15 minutes, if you talk, I will, you know, come and murder you. And
he didn't seem that scary. I'm surprised that worked.
He goes on.
Passive. That must have been his big aggro moment.
I have the transcript.
Evening.
Right, exactly. He got it all out. I have the transcript. It goes on for like a page and a half of him telling him to be quiet. So that's weird. And then the rest of the room is draped in black curtains. I guess it's a camera thing. And so you're in this weird tomb. So I was at the end of the tomb.
It was Barack Obama's tomb.
Right. Yes. And I was at the end of the tomb. So when you say in the room, it's a highly unnatural place. But it was certainly the feeling among all the journalists who were there that Romney had a commanding night. And I guess the question for you guys as observers is why he felt commanding.
He was very crisp, and he was on his points and doing what you're supposed to do in a debate, where you set up a kind of simple proposition and then you offer a few examples. And he obviously had lines he'd practiced, and some of them were effective. But I want to object to your word beatdown, and not because I'm defending Obama. I don't think that he did well. But it didn't feel to me like there was one person who was defeating the other person. It felt to me like a really wonky, often very boring, hour and a half in which the president was not effective. You made the point, well, John, in your piece, that he was backing into his arguments. And he seemed to me to be in a bad mood. But I didn't feel like there was any kind of devastating blow that was being struck. It was more like attrition. And honestly,
well,
it's boring.
The question is whether you can have a beatdown when one of the participants is supine. I mean, the president was...
wasn't that good a joke, I have to say.
These
it was
people...
an easy crowd.
Hey, no. Offends the crowd. I think they're people of discernment and good judgment. Apparently I am the Mitt Romney of this exchange.
I'm going to Barack Obama, you know.
So, yeah, right, exactly. Because the question is that's interesting to me is somebody can win in the moment, in the night, on the television screen, but it lives only within the four corners of that screen in that moment. And so that's the big question, right, whether this is something that Mitt Romney can transfer into the rest of his campaign. And we can talk about the things that he said that for viewers, many of whom are maybe tuning into this entire campaign for the first time, he looks like a guy who's reasonable. He's not the Daddy Warbucks of the cartoon that the president's been trying to paint of him. The president's answers were sort of rambling, and when he made points, he sort of backed into them. But a lot of people talk about the visuals.
Right. I was talking to someone who was not a native English speaker about this, who had watched the debate and didn't really understand what was being discussed. But the thing he said to me was that it was, and he's an Obama supporter, he just said that it was depressing for him because it was so obvious that one person was commanding, one person was the alpha. And actually, I mean, going back to my original point, Emily, I it's not that I thought Romney was so great. It really was that President Obama felt like he didn't want to be there. He was tired. He couldn't speak in coherent sentences. That was what was so surprising from somebody who is such a good public speaker. And I actually had sorry to ramble on, but my own theory about this is that there is something that happens to you as president where you never have a debate as president. You end every debate as the winner because you're the president. And to really have, for the best thing they could have done was sort of have a debate practice with Michelle Obama as his foil, because she's the one who could have given him what for.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to think that through. Because those guys have special weaponry in their relationship that you probably couldn't deploy with Mitt Romney. But I think what was also...
Romney did try and pose as Barama's, you know, anniversary partner.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that... Well, you know, if you look at his opening statement, in which he sort of did... He touched all of the sort of things he was trying to do. He mentioned the woman in Ohio. By the way, everybody who was mentioned a real person in the debate was from a swing state. It was really... Yeah. If you don't live in one of those
eight...
Do you
think there are other states? I'm not sure we have people who live in the other parts of the country right now. They don't exist.
But, you know, he showed that he understood what people were going through. He was respectful of the president's marriage and made that little joke. Then he kind of respectfully attacked the president. Then he suggested a new way, outlined his 5 points. He, like, basically, if you just look in terms of what you were saying, in terms of his crispness, that first answer is a good place to start.
Emily... We're talking a lot about the theatrics and the appearance of the debate, but it isn't, you know, we can be theater critics, but this is not, we're
purely
not electing
theater?
Someone to act
right.
In debate. So substantively, was the debate as much a triumph for Romney as it was superficially, number one, and number two, do we judge it by the substantive part or the superficial part? What will make a difference?
Well, this is the fact-checking part of the debate, because Romney was moving to the center. He was backing away from the notion that he had this $5 trillion tax cut. He was claiming that his health care plan will cover pre-existing conditions. There were several moments at which he said things that seemed to be essentially at odds with promises he's made, with his whole move to the right during the primaries and up till now. And I think that he will be held accountable. I mean, there was a lot of fact-checking going on today and discussion of that. And then the question is how much that penetrates. I mean, I imagine that the way in which the debate matters the most are the sound bites that get played the next day and over the next week, because I can't imagine that a lot of undecided voters sat through that whole thing when I was totally ready to fall asleep. And then is the fact checking accompanying the sound bites in a way that takes away, diminishes Romney's performance? Or is the narrative just, wow, he really won? And because that's a surprise, that's the thing that carries the day and that lifts him up. And then actually, it seems to me a problem that the president has to wait 2 weeks for his own next debate performance, in which presumably he can turn this around. We'll see.
Normally, debates haven't had huge effects on the various races. That, you know, John Kerry was seen to have won the first debate in 2004. Walter Mondale was seen to have won the first debate in 1984. Of course, he was behind by 17 points, so maybe everybody was just being nice to him. There's the historical problem. There's also the fact-checking problem, which is that for a candidate who has had a history of ideological malleability...
That's a lot of syllables for flip and flop.
A political person I was emailing with said, you know, the governor of Massachusetts finally showed up, which is to say that he's been kind of running away from his time in Massachusetts as a candidate, and now he was embracing health care, embracing the work that he did with Democrats. He said that Dodd-Frank, which he had previously said was a disaster, was really a big kiss from the president to the banks. So you have Mitt Romney attacking the president from the left for being too close to Wall Street banks. He talked about one of the things that he did, just in terms of the cleverness of the performance. We're still talking about the performance. We're transitioning to what it really means. But, you know, when he talked about regulation on the stump, he talks about regulation crippling the economy, being the thing that is holding the country back. But when in the debate, when you saw him, and he talked about Dodd-Frank, he said, you know, it wasn't the regulations themselves. He said regulations are necessary, but that it was the implementation, the execution. If you're watching it in the course of that debate, you can say, wow, that seems like makes perfectly good sense. He's a reasonable fellow.
Emily, were you taken in, or did you enjoy Romney's move to the center? Did you find it persuasive that he was presenting himself there?
No, I thought it was outrageous because it didn't seem real to me. I couldn't imagine that it was actually going to reflect how he would govern. It felt to me like he, and this was also why it was hard to watch Obama not challenge him, because you got this feeling that he was for free getting to take positions that are not reflect the whole, I mean, that was kind of amazing, actually, to watch someone so change the whole thrust of their campaign in the moment and not get called on it.
Well, you're calling him on it now. Good work.
Yeah, I'm sure he's listening.
What was striking to me about that debate was what was not said. There was no, as many people pointed out, no mention of Bain Capital, no mention of 47%. Romney said that line about needing a new accountant, which Obama easily could have made a joke about, and he didn't. There was no mention of any of the social policy issues that Democrats have been campaigning on regarding gay marriage or gays in the military or contraception or abortion. None of that was brought up. And is President Obama ever going to get a chance to use that stuff, Emily?
I mean, I think that's what he does next. There was some reporting today from, you know, people talking to his campaign about how well this had been a deliberate strategy that backfired, that he wanted to appear presidential, and so he tried to be more muted. He wasn't going to be aggressive. You know, I think it's how could anyone deny that this did not work, that he went too far in that direction and ended up supine lying on the floor? So
I
would say now there's a danger that he'll overcompensate, right?
Well, they said that he's, in talking to people with the campaign, they said he overlearned the lesson they told him, which was that he is doing well and being held aloft despite the weak economy and people's feeling about his stewardship, that people like him. And so those voters who thought Romney did well in the moment are still Obama-type voters. And if he comes out and is too hot, then he risks losing them, and that was the worry.
So, John, as a last question here, let's stay with the polls there. What is it that will tell us in the coming weeks whether this debate performance seriously changed the race? How are we going to know whether it seriously changed the race?
Well, I think you can look. So traditionally what's happened is that the sort of loser candidate keeps their percentage in the polls, but the winner candidate, theirs increases. So we would look for that in the national polls. We'd seen some tightening going into this race, by which I mean Romney had been improving. He'd shored up his support among his constituency, white men, basically. And that's not a joke. It's just where the numbers were moving.
There are a lot of them.
The But interestingly, not an, you know, maybe not enough for and that'll be one of the interesting questions of this election. But so you look in the national numbers and then obviously in the states where it's important. I think just one more point on the fact checking. When Romney talked about covering pre-existing conditions, he made it sound like he was doing a version of what the Affordable Care Act does. It's not true. His position is that he'll cover pre-existing conditions for people who already have coverage, which doesn't cover millions and millions and millions of people.
Okay, the next debate is October 11th, Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. It's going to be the vice presidential debate between Joe Biden and Paul Ryan, and I am looking forward to that just to see Joe Biden. Coming up, what will defeat on November 6th mean for Republicans or for Democrats? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson at Town Hall in Seattle, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic, but before we do, I want to bring out tonight's special guest. How often do you get to share a stage with one of your crushes? The author of the Savage Love column, the editorial director of The Stranger, the host of the brilliant Savage Love podcast, Savage Lovecast podcast, I should say, and along with his husband, Terry, the creator of the groundbreaking It Gets Better project. Dan Savage is a man of parts. He is an advice giver. He is a Google bomber. He is an incisive political thinker. I only wish I had some kind of really serious relationship trouble so I could ask him about it on stage. Please join us in welcoming Dan Savage. You got the hometown crowd, man.
I know, seriously. Yeah. Turns out they all came to see you.
I don't think that's true.
Thanks for being here, Dan.
My pleasure. Thanks for demeaning yourselves by inviting me.
So if Mitt Romney loses on November 6th, there will be Republican infighting. They will roast Mitt Romney on a spit, and the Republican Party will engage in some sort of civil war about where it's going. If the Democrats and President Obama lose on November 6th, there will be something similar. So we're going to spend this segment of the show talking about what is likely to happen. So, Dan, I'll open with you. If Romney loses on November 6th, do the Republicans have any direction to go but further to the right?
No. The Republican Party is the political equivalent of creationists. It's a faith-based party, and no evidence can persuade them that slashing taxes and regulations doesn't boom the economy despite all the data to the contrary. And they're just going to double, triple, quadruple down on this insanity. You know, the zombie Reagan politics, we're never going to be rid of it. My friend Andrew Sullivan has this fantasy that if they get their ass handed to them in a huge way, that they'll become the Tories, that they will embrace environmentalism and take global warming seriously and finally get over their, you know, hatred and fear of gay people coming to put our p***s inside them somewhere. And it's not going to happen. It's really not going to happen because they've completely merged with the right-wing Christianist nutbags. You know, Australia got the convicts, Canada got the French, and we got the Puritans, and now they are the Republican Party. And there's no pulling them apart.
All right, but the Tories is a great example. So the Andrew's fantasy is, I don't want to get into all of Andrew's fantasies, but let's talk about that particular fantasy of Andrew's. John, why is there no chance that there's a Republican Party that moves at least say on immigration, where there's a big get to make with Hispanics,
right,
that they, having lost this election, they think, okay, we've got to demographically adjust ourselves.
Right. So the counter argument is the one articulated by Lindsey Graham, which is basically we're running out of angry white men. Which is that basically, if you look at the country,
that's a great line. He said that.
Yeah,
I like that.
And it basically, if Mitt Romney gets Ronald Reagan's share of the white vote, he'll lose. So that the coalition of the Republican Party is disappearing, and that they have to fix that. I mean, that they will not be able to win elections if they don't do at least two things. One, change their position on immigration so that they have some return to some chance that they can attract Hispanic voters, many of whom live in crucial battleground states. But then also they have to change their approach to government in such a way that people who are, you know, swing voters in parts of the country that are not the South find something attractive in the Republican Party. And so that basically the demography will force them to be something different than what Dan's talking about. Although, of course, what Dan's talking about, those forces still are participating in the primary process. I mean, so that the clash will be between the purists and the more moderate forces, the same way the Democratic Party had its clashes with the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, and Bill Clinton, and sort of old-style liberals.
Well, I mean, I do think that the Republicans, the distinct advantage that the Republicans have over the Democrats is that they have a whole cadre of young people who have national identity, who can groom up as party leaders, which the Democrats don't seem to have. So they do have in Ryan, in Rubio, in Ted Cruz, in Christie, and all these folks, like legitimate people who are national figures.
Standard bearers. But that doesn't change the idea that you have to change, that the platform and the narrative has to be something different than it is. But if they just changed their line on immigration, would that be enough? I mean, could you? No. Why not?
Why not?
If you look at, for example, the gender gap, is usually measured, if you just look at the gender gap among whites, that doesn't have anything to do with immigration. And the fact that Mitt Romney is 25 points behind Barack Obama and that Republicans are traditionally very far behind Democrats with suburban women who tend to determine the outcome of elections, not a lot of them are voting on immigration. So changing immigration won't really do much to get at those voters.
Dan, do you see gay rights as an issue that the Republicans can change on? I mean, that's another one where demographically, given the polls, it would make sense for them.
I don't think they can change on it because they are a Christianist party and they're in bed with the Puritans. They are the Puritans. But I think they have to change on it, just like they have to change on immigration. I think they need to bundle these things together. Americans like to think of themselves as tolerant and inclusive. Even people who may disapprove of the way other people choose to live, who other people are, want everyone to feel like they have some stake in this and they aren't being persecuted. And I think a lot of those white female suburban voters, if the Republican Party shifted on beating up my hairdresser and beating up my gardener, maybe then I could vote for those assholes. But until they stop doing both of those things,
right, they're sort of cultural.
They're
markers,
not going to close the gender gap. People increasingly are seeing gay rights as kind of a talismanic marker, kind of an issue. It tells you a lot about who that person is, whether they believe in the full civil equality of your kid or your neighbor or your hairdresser who happens to be gay. And if they don't, you just sort of infer that they have other policies you might not approve of, or they're persecuting other people that you might like, and you're disinclined to vote for them.
Let's switch to the Democrats. If Barack Obama loses, which seems slightly more likely after last night than it did 2 days ago.
And which you think is still likely.
I still think it's probably going to happen. If Barack Obama loses, there's an obvious...
Descriptive.
There is an obvious candidate. The presidential, presumably the Democratic presidential nominee in 2016 will be Hillary Clinton. But the thing that I think as an observer that I find odd is that there doesn't seem to be anything after that. Where, Emily, are the Democrats going to find their next, you know, non-Clinton?
See, I feel like this is a long time from now. That
Chelsea?
It will just become apparent. I don't have the answer at my fingertips, but in the next couple of years... Debbie Wasserman Schultz comes to mind, although I feel like her name is too long and she's too... But there'll be other people who will come
forward. The governor
forward.
Of Maryland.
Yeah, Romali.
Did you see his convention speech?
Yeah, he was really...
that was great.
Deval Patrick was really good at the convention. They'll just come forward. I know, yeah. I don't know.
You're just
well, remember when Clinton ran the first time, it was the seven dwarves, and there were no serious Democrats right. in the race. They were all nobodies, and Clinton emerged from that pack.
Exactly.
And
that
so
was the better
there
answer.
May be a bunch of nobodies who emerged to run in 2016, and one of them could be the next Clinton or the next Obama.
So that'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. I'm David Plotz in Seattle, handing you off to Stephen in a dank little studio in New York. Thank you all for coming out.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture GabFest Stow Your Blunderbuss edition. On today's program, the new sci-fi thriller Looper, and the beloved sitcom Cheers turns 30. And finally, we talk Grizzly Bear and the state of indie rock with Nissa Ababa, the music critic for New York Magazine. Joining me today are Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, our film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Dana, I'm going to start with you. The new sci-fi thriller Looper. For those in our audience who haven't seen it yet, let me give a little background without – it's quite the needle to thread here is giving enough background so people who haven't seen the movie can listen to a discussion about it without spoiling it for them because this is an eminently spoilable film. But anyway, Looper is a sci-fi thriller. It stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a hitman in the year 2044. Fact check me as I go, Dana Stevens. His job is to contract to kill people delivered to him from 30 years in the future when time travel has been made possible. To help cover their criminal tracks, sometimes the future crime lords send back the future self of a current hitman to be killed by his current self. By his younger self. This gives nothing away, by the way. I think all of that is in the first few minutes, couple minutes of the film. None of that is delivered as a surprise in the film, so it has not been spoiled, save your angry emails. And it gives nothing away to say that the movie is about the complication that ensues when Gordon-Levitt confronts his older self, who's played by Bruce Willis. This is a very thought-provoking, kind of in the inception mode, extremely thought-provoking, intricate, nonetheless, blockbuster thriller. What did you make of it? I'm so curious to know.
Yeah, to me, the comparison that pops to mind is almost more Christopher Nolan's Memento than his Inception. But it does have that kind of Nolan-esque. This is a puzzle film. It's a kind of a logic puzzle of a movie and a time travel puzzle. Let's put it this way. Here are some of the things I liked about Looper. It's directed by Rian Johnson. It's his third movie, who I think of Rian Johnson as the director who sort of brought us Joseph Gordon-Levitt in his current form. He sort of started him on the path to becoming a movie star, which he, I think, with this movie and the last few he's been in, he has now become.
He was the kid on 30 Rock, right, and might have been associated
third
with...
Third Rock from the Sun. Different sitcom than 30 Rock.
Sorry, that's what I meant. and wouldn't have been necessarily naturally thought of as a movie star until...
Right. I mean, he had done some films. He'd done some really interesting films, but he had essentially done art films before this, a really great movie called Mysterious Skin that I love, but that nobody saw. And it was with Rian Johnson and Rian Johnson's first movie, Brick, that he kind of made his appearance. So I think of him as sort of a muse of Rian Johnson. I think they work well together, and that's really cool. I love that this is an original idea. It's not based on a graphic novel or a comic book or any other movie that's ever been made, and it's a great idea. The first 20 minutes of the movie set up this situation that you described, this kind of existential encounter between the current hitman self and who's supposed to kill his future self, and all of that is fantastic. But to me, and I hate to say it because people are loving this movie and they're loving talking about it, I didn't think it lived up to its promise. I thought it fell apart slowly, bit by bit, and by the last act of the movie had completely lost me.
Julia, what do you think? Bar set too high?
Well, I guess I take issue with your word thought-provoking. This is a puzzle film, and I found this puzzle interesting and sustaining, and I think actually more interesting and more successful than Inception, which felt a little bit bloated with its own sense of self-importance to me, and Memento, which gave me a headache and made me dizzy. I think basically I just like Rian Johnson better than I like Christopher Nolan. I found this to be a very satisfying cinematic experience. I particularly liked how when the action ends, it just ends, and you expect some stupid, bloated Hollywood coda of the sort that you always get, and then there's just credits. It was like the most blissful ending of a movie I've seen in years.
I think the word you're looking for is bloata.
Yes, there was no bloata. It was just a beautifully ended movie that ended when it should have ended. But I don't think I'll ever think about it again. I do not think it like played with the pleasures of time travel and all the whoa, but wait, but what if, but oh my God, but you could change, but like all those like headache mysteries that you can get with a good time travel movie. It doesn't really experiment with in a particularly interesting way. And I think that's part of the fun of a time travel movie. If you're going to make a time travel movie, there's a scene where Gordon-Levitt and Willis are confronting each other at a diner and they start to ask each other questions about their lives and how their interactions will affect their future lives.
I don't want to talk about time travel, because if we start talking about it, then we're going to be here there all day talking about him, making diagrams with straws.
That was the best line and the best scene in the movie, and there needed to be much, much more mm-hmm. of those encounters between the old self and the young self. I honestly can't think of any other scene in which the two of them had any real dialogue except terse lines before attempting to blow each other away.
Yeah, well, let me say one snarky thing about the movie before I go on to praise it lavishly, because I really liked it. Well, not lavishly, but it did seem to me as though Rian Johnson is the man who's sent back into the past to make La Jetée and Terminator. Right? I mean, there is a way in which this movie is – I've endorsed it in the past. There's a very short but very classic French movie. It's about 20 minutes long. It's in black and white. It's actually a series of still photographs with a voiceover called La Jetée, which directly inspired the movie 12 Monkeys, but is truly a classic. And he admits to it being an influence. He then goes on to say also T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets and Macbeth. And this is, you know – I did feel as though at moments there were a lot of pop culture influences that had been thrown into a blender. He actually also mentions the movie Witness for reasons that when you see the movie will become pretty obvious, the old Amish thriller with Harrison Ford and Kelly McGillis. But nonetheless, there were so many things I did like about it. I thought, first of all, he was aware of this. To the degree that the movie was at all derivative, it was self-conscious. Lisa, and in a kind of homage-directed way, which I thought was great. I just thought it was a very, very effective sci-fi thriller shaded with just enough kind of brain tease and, you know, genuine thoughtfulness that it made it totally delightful. I enjoyed it through and through, and it seemed to hang together pretty well. If you kind of knocked at it, it wasn't tapped at it. It wasn't hollow, you know.
Did you guys find, we can't spoil the end, obviously, but we can say as much as this. We can say that the end raises questions that every time travel movie raises and tries to kind of resolve them in a novel way about different alternate realities and how do you change the future if you change events in the past. Did you guys feel that was handled in an intellectually satisfying way?
I just didn't think there was anything intellectual about it. I think it just ended and I don't know. I didn't think it seemed that surprising. It didn't leave me with many lingering questions. I mean, I will say, for all that I'm being slightly dismissive about this movie's charms and ambitions and larger thought-provokingness, it was great. It is great to go to the movies and see an original vision that is not derivative of something else, that is somebody's own, you know, fascinating idea. I mean, obviously, it has many influences, but is its own fully realized concept. And I thought a really beautifully visually realized version of the future. I mean, it's Blade Runner-ish, and it draws plenty of influences from plenty of places. But I loved seeing this future world where they lived and the detail of it and how it was rendered. And I'm for more of that. I mean, I wonder if this is part of a larger trend of blockbusters that don't suck. Can we hope for a larger trend of blockbusters that don't suck?
I know. I thought this did sort of suck, so I'm not the person to answer that. But I agree that the production design is really notable. It's a great vision of the future that's not actually that Blade Runner. It's not glam. It's not glitzy, the future that Rian Johnson imagines. It's really sort of grim and gritty. And even the places where these big crime lords are having their secret lairs are just these kind of grim concrete boxes. And so I liked the kind of low-rent dystopia that it pictures. But ultimately, I mean, this movie is really violent and really gory. And the gore is pretty graphic. When somebody gets shot, when one of these people gets sent back from the past, right, they're masked, they have a hood over their face, their hands are cuffed behind their back, they're kneeling. It's an image that really brings up images of torture, war. I mean, it's pretty gross when they get blown away and little bits of flesh are flying out as this blunderbuss shoots them at close range. So you have to know that you're going to have to tolerate a lot of that going in.
This movie did not leave you wanting a blunderbuss?
Well, it could come in handy.
I kind of wanted a blunderbuss.
I say looking at Steve.
I was going to say, Dana, exactly when would it come in handy?
Close range, my friend.
Uh-oh.
Turn it upon thyself. All right, well, the movie is Looper. It's directed by Rian Johnson. It stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis. Check it out. Coming up, can you even make a living as a rock star anymore? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC.
Thank you.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show.
Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got.
The sitcom Cheers debuted on September 30th, 1982. That is, if you're doing the math, roughly 30 years ago. It promptly fell to the bottom of the ratings, where it hovered for almost the entirety of its first couple of seasons. But it won Emmy Awards. It was beloved by the NBC brass, in particular, apparently, Brandon Tartikoff, who championed it in-house. And it finally rose to become one of the most popular shows in all of television history. GQ, the magazine, has published an oral history. Our intern, Sally, is an epic fan, and I myself absolutely loved it at the time, at least for the first few seasons, as did, oddly enough, Kurt Vonnegut. Did you know this? That Kurt Vonnegut once famously said, I would trade in the entirety of my work for having written Cheers instead.
I love that, and I love the speculation among the creators. Should we let Vonnegut write write an episode? And then they said, nah, what if it sucks? We can't change it.
Yeah, what are you going to say to Kurt Vonnegut, right? But it was Vonnegut's, you know, hyperbolic love of the show that raised an intriguing question, right, about also dealing with past and future selves, which is, do sitcoms, which seem, Dana, so powerfully relevant at the time, well, you know, at least when I used to watch them, I connected with them deeply. I'd watch them every week. They'd make me laugh. I loved the characters. I wanted to beam myself into the universe of Cheers or Mary Tyler Moore or on and on and on and on. Do they actually hold up, though? I mean, you know, can you go back 30 years later and watch these TV shows, and do they hit you with the same force, or does it seem like getting back together with an ex-girlfriend and then you immediately regret it?
Yeah, I knew going in that we were all going to rewatch the Cheers pilot, and we were going to think about this question of sitcoms and do they hold up. And I'm afraid that I'm not that well positioned to answer the larger question of whether sitcoms hold up, because I'm sure there are many that don't. But in the case of Cheers, I thought the pilot was still just as funny and just as fresh and an absolutely awesome piece of TV. It actually made me want to skip this taping so I could sit and watch some more Cheers episodes on Netflix.
Julia, were you a fan of the show at the time, or were you born at the time? Did you exist?
I was born and I lived in Boston.
Okay.
So
two for two.
I was very aware of it, but I don't think I really started watching it until reruns a little bit later on in its run.
It was just, I mean, it wallpapered reruns in the 90s, right? It was just everywhere. You couldn't miss Cheers.
But I love Cheers. I mean, I love that setting. I love those characters. I love that bar. And something about the Boston-ness of it. I mean, growing up in Boston, you really did feel like it was your show in a certain way. And the characters felt true to a sense of place in a certain way.
All right. Well, we all watched. I should say I didn't watch the pilot. I watched the two episodes that end season two, which are considered kind of classic episodes of Cheers. Nonetheless, we all reacquainted ourselves with the show. What was it like, Dana, to go back and re-encounter these, you know, Sam and Diane in the bar and Norm and the whole lot?
Well, I guess to me one of the reasons that it didn't feel dated at all is that the show's humor is not that topical. It's not that political. It's really sort of a classic three-act drama and structured very much as such. And something that I really appreciated, I think it was Les Charles, one of the co-creators that said this in that oral history, was that it was very important to them to make it have that three-act structure and always have what he called a button at the end and end on a joke, and that it didn't set out to be an episodic kind of sitcom, although it did grow into that later as the Sam and Diane relationship became a saga and every character kind of developed their own arc. But it started out at the beginning to be a show that you could just watch as a self-contained half hour, even if you knew nothing about the characters, and it would stand up and hold up. And I really admire that old-fashioned craftsmanship with which it was written.
Oh, really? I feel like it's the opposite thing about it that's novel and that helps it hold up, that there is this arc, that the characters took on such a life beyond the walls of those, you know, 22 minutes, that you really wanted to see what they were going to do from week to week and how their relationships would change and how their interactions would evolve and how the characters would grow. I mean, I think the idea of, you know, learning and growing on a sitcom was not widely prevalent beforehand. It was just sort of the situation repeated every time with slightly different iterative results. If you think about, I don't know, Bewitched or I Dream of Jeannie, they were not characters who were evolving and developing. And the famous quote from Larry David about, you know, the founding ethos of Seinfeld was no hugs, no lessons. I mean, Seinfeld in the 90s was basically a response to the kind of show that Cheers, I think, among some others, had given us, where Cheers wasn't a hugs and lessons show, but it was a show where the characters had relationships that felt real and really evolved and changed over time. And I mean, I loved Seinfeld at the time, and I watched it week after week, and my entire family and my husband can quote every episode ad nauseum, but I don't love watching it anymore. I'm probably going to get kicked out of my house tonight when I come home, but I don't think it holds up in the same way, because the relationships of the characters at the core are not as strong or fully developed.
It's not warm, right? Seinfeld is not a warm show, and Cheers is extremely warm.
Yeah, it's purposely cold. But what strikes me about the GQ oral history and and rewatching some of these old episodes of Cheers is that Cheers arrived at a very, very specific moment in television history, right? They, in the GQ oral history, identify it as the last moment that people who grew up before TV were still writing for TV. When someone at NBC, I can't remember who, got the pilot script, they said, oh my gosh, they're bringing radio back. In other words, this is so verbal. They talk about the influences being Dickens, not I Love Lucy. And then the second thing is it was before cable TV, right? So when you had so few slots to fit shows into, and they had to aggregate massive audiences. They couldn't be niche products, so they couldn't be snarky. They couldn't go after a highly desirable but relatively limited in size demographic. You had to build a big audience. Cheers could not have survived in cable TV if it hadn't moved up the ratings, if it hadn't built a large audience, and it did. So what I like about it is its both literariness and its innocence, I think, still come through. It doesn't drop a lot of names. It's not ironic. It's not self-aware at all. At the same time, it's strikingly human. But nonetheless, why do sitcoms mostly suck when you go back and try to watch them? We got to hammer this theme. Have you ever tried to rewatch All in the Family?
I feel like you went into this topic with this framing, and you're determined to frame it this way. But can you give us examples of sitcoms that don't hold up?
Have you tried to rewatch All in the Family or MASH?
No.
it's brutal. Let me tell you, it's harrowing. All right, Dana. Well, we'll agree to disagree without blunderbussing one another. But tell me very quickly around the table, what's your favorite sitcom of all time, Dynasty?
Oh, boy. Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, if we're going to start going back in time, Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart, those shows are fantastic, too. Maybe Mary Tyler Moore. Let's go with that. That's a classic sitcom with a laugh track, half-hour format.
Yeah, and I think it's from a while ago, Dana. I don't know. Are you able to rewatch it without just blowing your eyes out? Without going back in time to kill your future self that made the decision to go back in time to watch Mary Tyler Moore?
I mean, this thing's dating, I think, is all art dates. I think it's very unforgiving to go back to a sitcom and say, why isn't it as funny to me as it was in 1983 or something like that? Because history's changed, you've changed, time has changed. I don't think sitcoms are things that are necessarily made to be consumed 30 years later.
Which was the very thesis you just threw back in my face 15 seconds ago. But anyhow, moving on. Julia.
I'm a sucker for a show that has more heart. I mean, it sounds cheesy, but I like a sitcom where the characters really care about each other. I love Cheers. I actually have kind of come late to Frasier, which I know Kelsey Grammer just comes off like a jerk in that GQ interview, and it seems like he basically is a jerk. But that show has a bit of both, right? It has a bit of the real characterizations. You know, Frasier obviously is drawn from the Cheers universe, and then some of the arch, clever, tight drawing room plotting of a sitcom. That's one that definitely holds up. It's maybe not my favorite of all time, but it holds up.
Mm. I think the form never grew beyond Gilligan, frankly. My favorite probably would be just so tough, man. I mean, just in its heyday, The Simpsons was so...
Oh, The Simpsons. If that counts, yeah, maybe The
Simpsons. I mean, it was so new. It was so smart. It was just so much smarter than anything. It was so... The perceptiveness of it, the satire of it, I mean, it's just so remarkable.
And those characters are real characters.
And the fact that you are interacting on a human level with these weird...
Yellow blobs.
Exactly. Humanoids. But I would say that or maybe Larry Sanders. I mean, I thought Larry Sanders was just totally path-breaking and brought a level of cruelty and cynicism that was refreshing. It's terrific. All right. Well, then, listeners, flock to our Facebook page and tell us what your favorite sitcom of all time is. We'd love to hear it. And whether you've watched it recently and it holds up. Dream the law. Grizzly Bear is an indie rock band from Brooklyn, or associated with Brooklyn, or Brooklyn-esque in some way or another, and they're having a moment. Their last album sold almost 250,000 copies, and they are publicly adored by, among others, Radiohead and Jay-Z. Their latest album is Shield, upon which occasion the rock critic for New York Magazine has written a piece, "In my head, Nitza, you will forever... I mispronounce your name already. You will always be Nitsa Abebe, but you must now tell me that it is, in fact, Nisu Ababa?
That's correct.
Okay. In your really terrific piece, you write, "Many grizzly bear songs are shaped like storms. A few phrases hover eerily into view, then roil around one another until they reach a peak. A sense of conjuring remains." I thought that was a beautiful description. Their music isn't or hasn't been structured around the traditional song structure. What is it about this music that fascinated you and that led you to write such a kind of myriad-minded piece about who they are?
It was a question of how you sort of assemble a career when you're a band like that. That was most fascinating. I have always liked their music. I think that they started off with that sort of conjuring loose feel, partly because a lot of them are sort of jazz and classical, have jazz and classical backgrounds, which I think allowed them to do that. And over time, they sort of moved more toward something accessibly pop-minded, maybe. And so part of the question for me, I guess, was how you wind up there, what makes a band wind up there, how much you're thinking of your career as you move in that direction, and how much why it is that bands will sort of grow toward popularity and also grow toward being interested in songwriting, perhaps, and which of those things comes first. So those are sort of the questions.
Much of your piece is taken up with the economics of being an indie band and the money troubles of being an indie band, even one that seems to have broken to the degree that this band has. They're now selling by a factor of 10 more records than the traditional indie band, which sells maybe 20,000 to 30,000 records.
Yeah,
they're
absolutely
now selling 200,000 to 300,000. And is that what puts them in this sort of odd, slightly poignant position where they want to stay authentic and small in sound, but they're on the verge of something much larger, and it's an identity crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could – I guess one way of looking at them would be as like this band that has not succeeded as becoming a pop band, but I think it's very much the opposite, that they're an indie band who's done remarkably, remarkably well and are still going about making their music in a way that's not going to sort of make decisions that might make it easier for them to get on the radio. That's not sort of the approach that they're taking, yeah.
I have a question about the economics. Is this a new situation that someone in this – I'm trying to figure out what is new about this situation. Is it that this kind of music is even charting at all? Is it that a group of this sort could even get as big as it has gotten? Or is it that there's now, because of the economics of the music industry and the fact that we're all ripping off artists every time we play Spotify, which was – laid out very beautifully in a graph in your piece that was somewhat shocking, and I'm going to have to go delete Spotify from my phone immediately as soon as we tape this segment. What is it that has put them in this financial bind? Is this the timeless plight of the passionate artist, or is there something new about the economics of the music biz that's changed matters?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it seems like a very short blip in human history where musicians could live well off of the sales of albums, and that is sort of coming to a close, and I don't know that that's catastrophic news. What seems new to me maybe is that for grizzly bears, I think they do okay, but probably part of their worry is that it's a short-term okay. Like maybe if you're insanely lucky doing something like that, maybe you get 5-6 years during which you make what a dentist makes, and then you sort of wonder, then you have an empty resume that says indie rock for,
Nissa, can you talk a little bit about touring as an absolute necessity now for bands? There's quite a bit in your piece, and I assume that this is part of a trend that's growing in the music industry in general, that you have to keep touring to support yourself since record sales aren't going to do it anymore. So these guys do have exhausting lives on the road.
And this is another one of those things that's like a reverted to maybe where it was before the brief blip in human history where you could sell a lot of records, that, musicians make money by performing.
Wait, when did that blip start?
I don't know. Probably at some point in the 60s, maybe, if you had a good record deal then and weren't getting exploited. maybe there were, some acts that could, get away with not having to be performing all the time. Most acts now, have to perform a lot. And I think that's something that maybe for Grizzly Bears is a decent source of income. A lot of the other musicians I talk to for this piece, it's much more of a grind. It's sort of touring around in a van and not being able to take time off to write and, record more music to tour on again because you don't have time to take off from tour. You don't have the money to take 2 months off and, make more product. It seems like definitely a grind, a kind of sleeping on floors grind for some people that they're doing because they, really want to stay in this.
All right. Well, Nisa Ababa, did I come close?
Sure.
Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us. It was a total pleasure.
No problem. It was great to be here.
Nisa's article, Down and Out in the Top 10, appears in the October 8th issue of New York Magazine. Well, now it's time for endorsements. Dana, what do you got this week?
All right. I'm going to do a rare regional endorsement because I did an activity in New York City this weekend that was so great that anybody who's in or near New York should definitely try it. I went to the Evolution store in Soho. Do you guys know this store?
That store is great.
It's just this little tiny store on Spring Street. It's 120 Spring Street in Soho. And I hadn't been there in years, but it's just a fantastic store. What would you call it, Julia? It's sort of a anthropology, archaeology.
It's like they have preserved butterflies and strange ceramic scarabs and
snake skeletons,
human skulls, and odd books about botany. It's like a great place to take an 8-year-old child of either gender.
Well, I took a 6.5-year-old, and we had the most amazing time. And the thing I specifically recommend to do, whether you go there with a child or not, it's great, is look at the butterflies in drawers. There's actually, it's a little bit like going to a bug museum because they have this wall full of drawers you can pull out and look at little beetles and butterflies on pins. I suppose you could buy them. They're probably astronomically expensive. But the staff there, in addition to being painfully hip, is painfully smart about entomology and archaeology and whatever else is in the store. And so you can sit there and talk to a girl with multiple lip piercings about scarab varieties for hours, and it's a wonderful store.
Fantastic. Julia, what do you got?
Well, I'm somewhat ashamed to say that I've had one of those months where my main mode of recreation has been watching TV while simultaneously playing Klondike Solitaire on my phone. Like, I've literally been frying brain cells every night. I don't know why. I've been too exhausted, and every book I've started I haven't been into. But finally, the clouds broke. They parted this weekend, and I started reading a book that I could not put down, which is Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. This is a book that I'm sure some friend of yours has already fervently pressed into your hands because it is that kind of book that people avowedly evangelize. And I'm only barely a bit of the way into it, but I'm in love with it. It's just wonderfully complex and beautifully written, and maybe I will hate it by next week, in which case I'll come and fess up, but I'm happy to be kicking my sad brain-swizzling habit. And also, I should say, actually, Slate's Audiobook Club is doing Cloud Atlas for a future episode, either the next one or one of the ones after, I think in tandem with the new Wachowski Tom Tykwer adaptation that is coming out this fall. So there's all kinds of cultural currents urging you Cloud Atlas word.
Excellent. Well, I refuse to be outbrowed, so I'm gonna see your Cloud Atlas and up you William Butler Yeats, which has been the poet, the Irish poet.
No Zola this week?
No Zola this week. But the Irish poet has been put into my mind by the idea of a self confronting its anti-self, which was one of Yeats's favorite themes. He returned to it over and over again. One of the best poems he wrote about it was Ego Dominus Tuus. Don't be put off by the Latin-y title. It's just so amazing. Because I seek an image, not a book, those men that in their writings are most wise own nothing but their blind, stupefied hearts. I call to the mysterious one who yet shall walk the wet sands by the edge of the stream and look most like me, being indeed my double, and prove of all imaginable things the most unlike being my anti-self. On and on and on. I love Yeats when he goes into that mode. Dana, you're looking at me as if you like me for the first time.
I was just imagining
a disorienting experience.
She's sheathed her blunderbuss.
I was just imagining that had been the voiceover for Looper right before the diner scene. That would be fantastic to hear you intoning that Yeats poem. But there's another Yeats tie-in to our topics this week, which is in the pilot episode of Cheers. Diane is sitting there at the bar waiting for her poetry professor fiancé to come back to the bar, and she's reading Yeats.
No! Fantastic.
All right. It all comes together.
Well, thank you, Dana.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest. And you'll find the longer podcast version of our show in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Volo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you next week.